I'm going to take people's names first so I can make sure I get everyone so I don't miss anybody out. So if you can indicate now if you want to say something or contribute, I can trim you down. I'll go through everybody as a list, and then when we run out of people stuff, we can have Steve in with something. Okay, so I've got Steve Mills, Ernest, Tom Clark.
No, sorry, comrade. All I was going to do is suggest if anyone wants to sit down there, there's some spare chairs down there.
Okay, so a minute, we've got Tom, we've got Math, I can sit at the back, and we've got Alan, yeah, at the front. Is there anyone else who wants to speak before I... Okay. Oh. Math, okay. Anyone else? Okay, then. Tom?
Yeah, thanks, Sam. It's going to be a bit disjointed, because I didn't know exactly how it was going to go. I was involved in the building strike in 1972, when the miners was on strike in February. I was too about the Depression, so I wasn't involved then. But when the building workers came on strike in July, my dates aren't exactly correct. I was involved significantly with strike pickets and flank pickets. So, you know, I can only talk about my experience then. It was actually more workers was on strike with the building strike than since, you know, it was 350,000 to 380,000 workers, more than since the general strike beginning of September. So it was a massive involvement of workers. I mean, I just start with a negative in a sense. I didn't see, I mean, the actual, I worked on Evening Post, job that's there now. Now that was supposed to be designed with Kitson in mind, you know, so the actual white collar workers were separate from the manual workers, you know, the printers was on one side of the line, and the management was up the top where they could be helicoptered off, so you couldn't actually go to the top, you know, and I worked on the Evening Post job at that time. So, you know, that was a design from those arguments. But, I mean, the action of the workers at that time did have a reaction from the ruling class, but I don't think necessarily from my experience the workers was that politically, you know, I mean, Vietnam and then eventually Northern Ireland, I would have thought that the ruling class was terrified of the mass. Have you seen the pictures there of the video? Of masses of workers screaming their heads off on the strikes. And you know, masses of building work, even Bristol, we had 1,000 a flying picket one day of 1,000 and cut, you know, the Oddity Inn we closed as well at one point, you know. And next to the Transport and General Workers Union, well, it's not just United, isn't it, but Transport House next to there, we closed that site down on that particular day. But when, before the strike, and I remember going to union meetings and people were saying to me on the left, and I was in IS at the time, which is now Socialist Worker Party, and in a minute, that's where Bristol Socialists came from. But people had asked me what would happen in Bristol, and I said, well, I didn't think anything would happen. But building workers' leaders went on the sites, and it was like the Pied Piper, and workers just followed them off. Yeah. I mean, I was mesmerised myself. They just went whoom, off the site. And one or two didn't, but most workers just walked. I think the most surprised people of all was the union leaders. I mean, they just didn't expect that that was going to happen. So, you know, I mean, that was my experience there. As far as the practical idea of the strike, I was on a site that wasn't called that one strike. It was Colston School, Staple, anyway. And we weren't called on strike, but eventually I felt I had to come out myself. So there were only sites called out, but and we actually did win a massive increase in wages, I think to £26, like £1 an hour and £6 bonus, which, so that's what it, you know, I think we was on less than 10 shillings an hour at the time, just for people to know, 50p at today's rate. So we came out with a £20 rate and £6 bonus, like at the end of the day. And in fact, I mean, I was just on a, I think the Trades Council recently, and I was listening to somebody, and some of the firms like Cowan and some of the building firms were willing to pay straight away. You know, they were willing to sort of pay the money without any strike action taking place. So, you know, my experience from that is that, you know, most workers and the consciences of most workers, it was an economic strike. you know, that what the left or socialists could have been, if they could have been involved the class in the political debate that saw, you know, raised a consciousness like the ruling, in terms of the ruling class. But to me, the whole period was an economic period. Bristol Socialist actually came out of, I think Keith Elliott, I was in IS at the time, Jeremy Clark, who's involved in anti-war thing, and a few others of us, well, as we got kicked out of IS, because we had a view that, first of all, workers looked to reformism, and we tried to produce something. And I think I learned from producing Bristol Socialist. At the end of the day, we tried to give it to the Bristol Trades Council, but then it, you know, it petered out, sort of thing. So that was my experience of that period, and it politicised me, having come out of the army in 68. You know, when the Vietnam War demonstrations was on, you know, the Paris riots in 68. You know, it politicised my, and this was my first real action in that period. But I just generally indicate that I did see. I don't think any workers were seeing that as a revolution. It might have been a revolution in one way, but I don't see that most workers were seeing that as a revolutionary transformation of society, but as an economic process. I think the failure was of the left, and I still think it's that today, of actually involving those workers in political debate that can look towards transcending the capital.
Okay, thanks for that.
You might have mentioned that during the Berlin strike that we had the two guys.
Well, there was 12 children pickets, is that
right? Yeah,
yeah. Well, there was three eventually.
The two, your Des Warren and Ricky Thompson, done for conspiracy.
Yeah, I mean, they were, and the building, sorry about that, sorry. Yeah. Andy, I mean, and the union just didn't, you know, they were going to pay, you know, the, and Ricky Thompson said in recent years, you know, that he just didn't think he'd commit, well, hadn't committed anything really. They'd gone on a building site where somebody had actually, a foreman had produced a shotgun, and then from then there'd been a, you know, running around the site a bit, and I don't know the details, but I was up Shrewsbury, we was here, you know. So I mean, you know, there were those three workers were jailed, and that obviously warrants.
And been kept in jail by a Labour government.
Yeah. Okay, then Matt.
Really interesting, Dave, and also yourself and yourself there. I think about today, it's really interesting because it sounds like we're sort of in that situation before the big flowering of successful strikes. I really believe we're going to go to a period now where we're going to have successful actions against the cut. But it sounds like from what you're saying that obviously the top of the union was bollocks. They didn't want to know anything about it. You had organisations like the Communist Party, like the IS, and like sort of radical shop stewards that seemed to fire it all up. That's not the case today, and I don't want to get picking an argument with anybody like that, but you know, like, it seems to me like the left groups not doing well, and also, you know, there doesn't seem to be that big thing within unionism itself. So where do you see that spark coming from that's going to organise all the workplaces and things like that and turn it?
Okay, can I just stop you and have a few more contributions, and I'll come back and then we'll pass over to Steve as well.
Short one. When did pay policies first come in under Wilson? What year?
Just bear that in mind for a bit. Make some notes, Steve.
It's in the book.
You didn't have half an hour. Matt.
Yeah, just a question really about the changes, because I've been looking at some stuff recently at 1976, which in some ways was the watershed, wasn't it, where having got in, the Labour government kind of managed to deliver the economic paralysis that the IMF gave them the excuse for doing and the decline in living standards. At the same time, they managed to defuse this massively high level of militancy that had got rid of Heath, that had meant that Wilson had to jump in 69 and give up on any place to strike. So, you know, you had this great flowering of movement that I think you described very well, with political as well as economic elements to it, and yet somehow, you know, the ultimate fuel of it was that, you know, the Labour leadership, the prototype new Labour leadership of Callaghan and Healey that really bought the pass on the Americans, that they had to impose austerity, they got away with it. Now, you know, I'm a social worker myself, and we've tended to focus very much on things like the role of the left trade union leaders there in delivering in delivering this austerity for the Labour government during the 77-78 period, and that this so demoralised the rank and file that that's what led to the fact that Thatcher could get in subsequently. But I mean, would you agree with that? Would you disagree? Would you think there were other factors about why was it that this, you know, this automatic sense of solidarity, this sense of economic militancy and to a degree political militancy couldn't win over when the next crisis came in 76? What was it that diffused it?
Well, I mean...
Okay, hang on a sec. Well, one more thing.
Dave, I hear you've been involved with IWW, so I wonder if you could say a little bit about that and the experience of it. There's a few wobblers in the room as well, so good to get a bit of inspiration and history, maybe. And, just like the times that we're faced with, I recognise the government's going to do a lot of our work for us, but faced with such a sort of like alienated, isolated, pretty fragmented class, a lot of casualised labour now, deindustrialised, we've only got a heavy industry base.
Right.
Any suggestions you might have as to how we can really sort of take things forward and not be just sort of nodding wryly and going, one day, not being confined to doing that.
Okay. Dave, you didn't have your full time, so I'm going to give you another 5 minutes or so to come back. While we're left groups, pay prices, my militancy, IWW, and then we'll pass over to Steve Higgins.
The Wilson income policy started right from his terms of his second election. That was all part of it. And of course, they brought in the anti-union legislation. They were the first people to do that, as well as some progressive legislation, by the way, but that was the thing. I don't think that there was a decline in terms of militancy. There was at the back end in the 1970s, up to the run up to the election of the Thatcher government, but there was collaboration as union leaders and the official union apparatus wheeled its bandwagon behind them, and the old stuff about labour shit doesn't stink, we let them get away with. Let them get away with stuff. But I think there was still rising incidences of wildcat action, unofficial action, and workers making a stand. But you had the start of the intimidation stuff about secondary action, didn't you? Unlawful secondary action, cutting down on mass pickets and all of that stuff. I think the lesson as far as the IWW is concerned. I mean, somebody called the IWW now a very poor tribute band. And I think I think in a way that's probably right. The IWW is, which I've been a member of since we restarted it in Britain, is the right idea. It's a good idea. It's what we need to have. It's something on the lines of a more political version of the National Shop Stewards movement, which is also a good idea, which we need to link workers together. But I mean, it's undeniably true that the left has never been so distant from the working class as it is at the moment. The left has its own agenda, which is quite outside of the agenda of the working class, and we have no connection with those people. The only time the working class as a whole sees the left is when they come to tell us off about something. When they come to tell us that we're being racist or xenophobic or sexist or inappropriate or doing this or being logalouts or whatever. We're always getting wrong off the left. So there's a complete disconnection between representing the views of working class and telling people what they should think. And I think, we're not going to get out of that. It's partly to do with the fact as the decline of mass manufacturing and mass working class base, where previous leftists came from that base and had their fingers on the pulse. Now they're alienated from that. And as I was saying last night, I mean, manufacturing is something like less than 10% of GNP. So it's very, very difficult to... the whole economy is based around that square mile in London. If we seized the banks, what good would it be if they took the money away? It's not like seizing the shipyard like they did at UCS, where they continued building the ships. Because we could then demonstrate that labour was ours and we could make the things we needed without them. It's difficult once you've stopped making stuff and all you do is concentrate on the banking system, because then they can walk away and leave you literally in the shape, which is where we are. So it's incredibly more difficult to get from where we are now than where we were then. Which, of course, which is why they did it. I left out a number of things. I mean, something about the building workers. I mean, I left it out. You know, the building workers' strike was more violent than the miners' strike had been. And away from the public gaze, there was some quite violent actions from the bosses, thugs, you know, gangs of bosses' agents who attacked pickets and union leaders and stuff like that, and vice versa, of course. It was very, very violent action. But I also make mention of the fact that during this whole period, of course, we had the campaign for the EEC, the referendum on the EEC. Now, every single trade union in Britain opposed entry at the EEC, and every political party in Britain supported it. All of the left were against it, except the Maoists, who had some convoluted reason about forming a bloc against imperialism or something, by having a European, I don't know, something that Maoist said. But whereas now, people regard the EEC as some kind of internationalist gesture that has to be supported. You know, and I mean, nothing I've seen since then to now tells me that we were wrong the first time and we should never have went in there. But the idea of the EEC, of course, was to disarm particular organised sections of the working class across Europe, to make us all vulnerable to the lowest common denominator, to break the kind of strength. I mean, we were posing the United States of Socialist Europe or the Soviet Socialist States of Europe in opposition to the EEC. The EEC isn't that. And, I mean, that's still part of the problem. That Europe has effectively been deindustrialised and the exploitation of real production moved to the third world, where workers are less organised, have less union rights, if any, and can be slaughtered wholesale, like in China and places like that, you know. So they've shifted the whole balance. So whatever we do now has got an immediate global connection to third world struggles in a much more direct way than it did before, I think. But there's no easy answers, and I always make people feel more miserable at the end because I cannot see a way out, to be honest. we kicked this about the thing.
Yeah, we were talking about this about quarter past two last night. And,
we went to bed at home.